From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Shouting by L.T.C. Rolt. I companion Edward on many walking tours before I discovered that he had a positive phobia about woods. There was always some very good reason why we should not go through one. The obvious path, though marked on the ordnance survey map, might peter out or turn in the wrong direction. If it was hot, there would be too many flies in the wood. If it was evening, it would be too dark. Half the fun of walking was the view, and obviously there could be no view in a wood. But at last there came a day when none of these pretexts could avail him. On the contrary, it was quite obvious to us, both from the map and from the lie of the land, that to avoid going through this particular wood, which was quite a small one incidentally, would involve a needless and lengthy cross-country detour, including scrambling through many hedges. Just a kind of point-to-point walking that does not appeal to me. On the other hand, it was perfectly clear from the stile at the edge of the wood and the path beyond it that there lay a well-used right-of-way. Yet Edward stopped in his tracks and, knowing there was no valid excuse left to him, said with an unmistakable fear in his eyes, "I'd rather not go through that wood, if you don't mind." "Come on," I said. "It's only about a quarter of a mile wide, judging from the map, and if we leave the path, we're in for a hell of a scramble." Seeing that, he still hesitated. I mounted the stile with, "Oh, well, suit yourself. I know which way I'm going," over my shoulder. I think it was the nearest we ever came to a row in all our time together. What followed was really very odd, and cast an entirely new and strange light on my friend. It's odd how long you can know people, and yet suddenly discover that you know so little. Edward padded silently behind me, his eyes darting to right and left, as though that harmless Herefordshire coppice harbored every species of savage beast, with the odd poisonous snake thrown in for good measure. But it was no laughing matter at the time, and I confess that I felt a shade uneasy myself, for it was quite obvious that Edward was terrified, almost out of his wits. I was determined to get to the bottom of this unreasoning terror, and that evening, in the Scudamore Arms at Comber Combe, I tackled him about it. "I'm sorry I persuaded you to walk through that spinney with me. Honestly, if I'd realized that you felt so strongly about..." He cut me short. "Yes, the truth is that all woods scare me stiff. My mother said I never should play with gypsies in the woods," I quoted at him rather tactlessly. Edward gave me a curiously searching look, and, "What made you say that?" he asked sharply. Then he went on, "This has nothing whatever to do with cautionary nursery jingles of that kind. It is due to something that happened to me only 10 years ago, just before I met up with you, in fact." And then it all came out. He was staying in an isolated rented cottage in the bottom of one of those deep and narrow valleys that run down to the Atlantic coast of North Devon and Cornwall. The ridges between them end in formidable bare headlands and vertiginous cliffs that jut out to meet the challenge of Atlantic rollers. But one does not have to go far inland from the coast before their lower slopes are thickly covered with dense woods of scrub oaks, their tops combed by the prevailing southwesterlies that funnel up the valleys till they resemble a smooth green fleece. Well, Edward said he was lolling in a deck chair outside his cottage door and enjoying the hot sunshine of late July, when he suddenly heard the patter of feet and the chatter of children approaching down the lane. This surprised him, as there was no village within miles, but when he saw them, he thought they must be the children of gypsies who had camped nearby, for they were all olive complexion, with black hair and slow eyes. They were chattering eagerly together as though anticipating some rare treat, but for the life of him, he could not distinguish a word they said. Could they be speaking Romany? He asked himself. Surely not. A boy, who looked about 14, and appeared to be the eldest and the ringleader of the group, was in front, and as they passed opposite his cottage gate, Edward got up from his chair, stopped the little party, and asked their leader where they were going. Speaking in perfect English, the boy replied, "Oh, we are going up into the woods for the shouting." The way he said this implied that Edward ought to have known the answer without having to ask, but before he could betray his ignorance by asking what he meant, the boy had broken into a trot, and the others, silent now but still radiating a tense expectancy, followed him. Edward watched them cross the little wooden footbridge over the stream and then mount the slope until they disappeared into the wood. Then he went back to his deck chair, pondering on this odd little encounter, until he began to doze again. He was roused by what he described as the most unearthly racket, a shrill eldritch piping and shrieking rising every now and again to a frenzied pitch. So this was the shouting? It struck him as a scarcely human sound, sometimes reminding him of the squealing of slaughtered pigs, and sometimes of the strange cries he had once heard coming from a heronry. But what puzzled and disturbed him even more was that this shrill clamor seemed to have an accompanying ground bass, a kind of plain chant that was somehow far more horrible to hear. And at this point, Edward became almost alarmingly emphatic than the shouting itself. There could be no one in that party of children with a voice like that, he speculated. It must be an acoustic trick, something like the sound of the sea beating on the rocks at the end of the valley, unnaturally echoed and magnified in that narrow space between the hanging woods. So he rationalized his fear, knowing in his heart that such an explanation could not be true. It was some time before the children came back, long enough for the sun to have left the floor of the valley, although it still shone brilliantly upon the higher slopes above. They walked silently, two by two, over the wooden footbridge and past Edward's gate with never a sideways glance. He might not have been there, leaning over the gate watching them, he said. Soft-footed, they passed them by as though they were entranced, their lips slightly parted, their slow eyes staring fixedly ahead as though focused upon some remote distance. Young though the children were, Edward admitted he found the strange procession very awe-inspiring. He had sat on for a while in the deepening shadow before at length curiosity got the better of him, and he set off towards the wood in the direction the children had taken. He had noticed the spot where the children had entered the wood, for it was marked by a single ancient and stunted yew tree, which contrasted darkly against the green foliage of the oaks and their silvery lichen bearded trunks and branches. Once he had climbed the fence and entered the wood, he found no path, although the way was still clear to him because the children had beaten down briars, nettles, and bracken in their passing. Taller than they, he had to walk bent double to avoid the dense interlacement of branches. It was like walking through some low green tunnel. Suddenly, however, he could stand upright, for he found himself in a small round clearing in the midst of the wood, and thought it strange that it was not visible from below, considering the steepness of the slope, which had left him out of breath. In the center of the clearing was a low mound of short green turf, like an island in a pool of bracken. Edward walked onto the top of the central mound, and it was at once obvious that it was here that the shouting had taken place. Children were great traditionalists, he reflected. It was doubtless some old country game or ritual handed on by one generation to another. My mother said I should never play with the gypsies in the wood. That silly jingle came into his head unbidden, and refused to be banished. Evidently they did not forbid such play in these parts, but positively encouraged it. And then he laughed out loud at this feeble joke, and then he started at the most remarkable echo. Of course, woods were famous for this kind of thing, he thought. But then something much more remarkable and alarming happened. The laugh was repeated from a different part of the clearing, and this time it was no echo, but a sound such as he had never made in his life. A deep, short sound, half bark, half bray, human and yet inhuman. The laugh came again, almost the next instant, menacing this time, and from the opposite side of the clearing, although he had heard no sound of movement in the wood. At this, Edward became terrified. He stood rooted to the spot, peering now this way, now that, into the darkening wood in an attempt to locate the source of such a dreadful sound. When the laugh came a fourth time, it happened to sound from the precise direction in which he was peering. It may only have been some trick of the failing light, he admits, apologetically, but an inchoate mass of twigs and oak leaves seemed suddenly to form itself into a gigantic head, a head with an aureole of leafy twigs in place of hair, a beard of gray lichen below a cruelly smiling mouth. There also appeared to be two red eyes, though this may have been the effect of the setting sun shining through chinks in the leafy canopy of the wood. But on reflection, Edward thought not. It strikes him how at a last desperate attempt on the part of his rational mind to explain in known terms the unknown. For the next instant, sheer panic seized him, and he blundered out of the clearing and down through the woods. Trees, nettles, bracken, and briars all seemed to conspire together to prevent his headlong flight. He nearly scalped himself on low branches. Nettles stung him, briars whipped at his clothes and flesh, and tough bracken stalks tripped him so that more than once he sprawled headlong. And all the while, that awful voice accompanied him, laughing and chuckling over his plight. He thought that if again he should see the face from which it came, his reason would snap, nor could he bear much longer the sound of that voice. And in a vain attempt to drown it, he began to yell at the top of his voice the first ridiculous words that enter into his head. "Mother said I should never play with the gypsies in the wood," he screamed hysterically. By the time he finally flung himself over the fence at the edge of the wood, his clothes were in tatters and blood was streaming down his forehead and into his eyes from the lacerations on his head. But the horror had left him, and thankfully he flung himself down the cool turf, now slightly damp with dew. There below him was the dim shape of his cottage beyond the stream, and he gazed at it as a traveler from the desert gazes at an oasis. "And that was that," concluded my friend. "Now you know why I dislike." "No, dislike is too mild a word. Why, I hate woods." "But what about those children?" I queried. "Did you?" He answered my question before I had finished it with a shrug of the shoulders. "No," he replied. "There were no gypsies in the district at the time. I made sure of that, and I'm equally certain they weren't local children either." After a pause, he went on. "I asked a good lady from Mortford, who came every day on her bike to do the chores for me, whether there was any legend or traditional custom connected with that particular piece of woodland. But all she would say was, 'I dunno, sir. Us dunno never go in there.' So your guess is as good as mine as to who or what the children were. Personally, now that I have heard Edward's story, I'm inclined to think that may have been the most frightening thing about the whole strange business." Eyes for the Blind by Frederick Cowles. "What I can never understand about your church," said Dr. Taylor, "is the manner in which it is so uncompromisingly condemned spiritualism. I will grant you that there is a lot of quackery about the average spiritualistic seance, but I do not think that some of the results prove that there is something in the serious study of the subject." "Then you would have the church risk immortal souls for the sake of the grain of truth there may be in what you yourself admit is a tissue of trickery," replied the bishop. "Not at all," answered the doctor. "What I object to is a wholesale condemnation of the researches of many people who are inspired by the highest motives. You cannot say there is nothing in spiritualism when it has been definitely proved that some kind of manifestations have been witnessed in circumstances that preclude trickery." "The church does not deny such manifestations, but she does declare that the spirits of the just are in the hands of God and cannot be raised at the whim of any neurotic medium at a seance. Those who have studied the subject, and there are many who have, agree that certain evil spirits can assume appearances to suit their purpose when souls are to be ensnared. For example, a man who hears his dead mother speaking to him at a seance is really being deceived by an evil spirit who is able to imitate the mother's voice." "A very thin argument, my lord, if I may say so," What about ghosts that haunt old castles or ruined abbeys? I have never seen any, smiled the bishop. And if there are such things, I should think they are really thought forms associated with the place. But the haunting of such houses is something apart from spiritualism. In that case, the things are actually there and are seen, or are said to be seen, without the assistance of any mystic agency. In spiritualism, the ghosts are raised through a medium. There must be a human agent in the matter. The raising of spirits in this way is such a severe strain upon the medium that many of these people have been known to go mad. I will not deny that. But what drives them mad? Has it ever been proved that the evil spirits, which you say appear at seances, have actually taken possession of the faculties of a medium? I think I can answer that question, my lord, if you will give me permission, interpolated Father Placid. Perhaps the doctor may be interested in the tale of Sidney Jackson. Of course, answered the bishop. I had forgotten that case, and as you had the handling of it, you should certainly know all the facts. The little Benedictine lit his pipe and puffed away at it for a few moments. Then he began his story. It was nearly 20 years ago that Sidney Jackson first came to see me. He was then a boy of 19 and wished to be received into the church. He struck me as being the ideal type of convert, serious and keen to know all the facts before he made his final decision. I remember that I was particularly impressed by his frank blue eyes and his delicate artistic hands. I instructed him for over 3 months, and then he suddenly stopped coming to me. Naturally, I wrote to inquire what had happened, and he replied saying that he had decided against joining the church as he had been convinced of the truth of spiritualism. I discovered that he had been brought into contact with Austin Lloyd, who you may remember was a famous medium just before the war. Lloyd had persuaded the youth that he possessed mediumistic powers, and the next thing I heard of Sidney was that he was giving seances in Mayfair. I wrote and warned him of the dangers he was courting, but received no reply to my letter. Then war was declared, and he joined the forces. Lloyd was killed at Mons, but Sidney came safely through and was the head of some spiritualistic church in London in 1919. In 1921, I was appointed chaplain at the prison. The governor was a Catholic, and he and I became very friendly. One day he called me into his office and said, "Father, we have a very curious case coming in tomorrow. Have you ever heard of John Dangerfield?" I shuddered. Who had not heard of John Dangerfield? This monster had been convicted of the most vile crimes. His mania was to attack unsuspecting persons, often children, and gouge out their eyes. He had blinded 5 people in this manner, 3 of his victims being little children. He was also suspected of attacking quite a number of others. He had been proved guilty of these revolting crimes, but sentence had been suspended as there were doubts regarding his sanity. "I see you know of him," went on the governor. "Well, he is coming here tomorrow, and the doctor is going to have a lively time trying to discover whether he is sane or not. According to the report, it seems to be a case of dual identity. At times the man is a low, gross villain, answering to the name of Dangerfield. At others, he's a very bewildered gentleman who claims to be Sidney Jackson." I must have given a start of surprise, which the governor noticed, and I had to tell him that I had once known a Sidney Jackson. "Perhaps it is the same man," he said. "Many people have come forward to swear that he is Jackson, a well-known spiritualistic medium, and not Dangerfield at all. Yet when the witnesses declare him to be Jackson, he vows that he is Dangerfield. Clearly the man is insane, and I don't know why he should be sent here at all." The governor willingly gave me permission to see the prisoner as soon as he arrived, and the following afternoon one of the warders conducted me to Dangerfield's cell. One glance was enough. It was Sidney Jackson, but the eyes and hands seemed to be those of another man. Instead of the well-remembered blue eyes and thin, delicate hands, this man's eyes were greenish-brown in color, and his hands were coarse and ugly. Yet he was certainly Sidney Jackson. "Do you remember me, Sidney Jackson?" I asked. He jumped to his feet with an oath, and mouthing many foul curses and blasphemies, declared that his name was John Dangerfield. Undoubtedly he was quite mad, and the warder led me quickly out of the cell. We looked back through the grill. The man was still shouting curses, and those cruel hands were clawing the air as if the fingers were itching to tear something to pieces. The next morning, I heard that he had actually attacked one of the warders and endeavored to push his fingers into the poor chap's eyes. Within 2 days, he was removed to one of the criminal lunatic asylums. The case rather preyed upon my nerves, and I could not dismiss it from my mind. With my superior's permission, I traveled up to London and visited the spiritualistic church where Sidney Jackson had officiated. The man in charge was suspicious of me at first, but when I told him the reason for my coming, he was more talkative. He told me that Jackson had been approached some 12 months before that date by the owner of some property in Scotland, who had invited him to conduct a seance in a haunted castle. Jackson had gone to Scotland, and it was after his return that the change in him had become evident. My informant gave me the name of the place in Scotland, and I went north on the following day. Ecclefane is off the beaten track, and I had to hire a car to take me there from Fort William. I found a tiny village with a grim old castle on the moors above. I was told that the castle was deserted, but the laird lived in a house about a mile from the village. He turned out to be a dour old fellow and not at all friendly. I asked him if he had been Sidney Jackson's host about a year ago. He admitted that he had, and I could see he was mortally afraid of something. "Would you like to tell me about it?" I asked. "Jackson is now in a criminal lunatic asylum, and declares that he is really John Dangerfield." "John Dangerfield?" he exclaimed. "Oh God, has it come to that?" "Now tell me the meaning of it all," I suggested. "It was no fault of mine," the man groaned. "I would never have asked him if I had even guessed at the consequences. I only wanted a chance to rid the old castle of its ghost. 3 generations ago, my family had to abandon it. And it's a poor thing when the laird of Ecclefane has to live in a pigsty like this while his own house is given over to a ghost." I agreed that it was, and he went on to tell the story of the haunting and the attempted seance. I cannot imitate his broad Scots dialect, so shall have to tell the tale in plain English. It seems that about 1694, the district around Ecclefane had been terrorized by a wizard. This man had practiced black magic in an attempt to discover hidden treasure, and human eyes had figured largely in his experiments. To obtain these, he had gouged the eyes out of little children, and had even gone to graveyards and taken the eyes from newly buried corpses. At last, the district had risen against him, and he had been haled before the laird. With primitive justice, the laird had directed that the wizard's eyes be burned out of their sockets, and the man then thrown from the top of the castle tower. This sentence had been carried out to the letter. The name of the wizard, as you may have guessed, was John Dangerfield. From that day, the castle was haunted by the ghost of a man without eyes, a ghost that endeavored to scratch the eyes out of any human being who crossed its path. Things were brought to a head when the infant son of the reigning laird, sometime in the 18th century, had been found dead with his eyes torn from their sockets. From that day, the castle had been abandoned. By chance, the present laird had heard of Sidney Jackson, and in a rash moment had invited him to Scotland, hoping that in some way he could discover how to lay the ghost. Jackson had decided to spend the night in the haunted castle. He left Ecclefane the next morning without saying a word to anyone. I returned to my monastery convinced that instead of laying the ghost of John Dangerfield, Sidney Jackson had become possessed by the evil spirit of the wizard. For over 2 months I grappled with the problem. And then one morning there came a telephone call from my friend, the prison governor, asking if I would go over to the lunatic asylum at once and see the man who called himself John Dangerfield. The asylum is about 14 miles from the abbey, but I soon covered the distance on my motorbike. A doctor was there to meet me, and he told me all the facts of the case. After 2 months of continual madness, Jackson had suddenly become quiet and had answered to his own name. That very morning he had asked the authorities to get in touch with me and to say it was a matter of life and death. The doctor took me along to the cell where Jackson was confined. The blaspheming wretch I had interviewed 2 months before had changed into a cultured gentleman. Blue eyes looked into mine, and the hands were the delicate white hands I used to admire so long ago. He greeted me eagerly. "Father," he exclaimed, "it is good of you to have come. Please keep him away from me. If he comes back, I shall be doomed forever. If only I had taken your advice, and had nothing to do with spiritualism. We talked for some time, and it was obvious that he knew little of what had happened while he had acted as John Dangerfield. He expressed a desire to be received into the church, and I agreed to perform the ceremony that evening and to bring him the Blessed Sacrament in the morning. He hated my leaving him, but I had to return to the monastery for the necessary things. I was only away for a few hours, and fortunately, he was still the same when I got back. I gave him a short instruction, went through the order of reception, administered conditional baptism, and heard his confession. Dusk had already fallen by then, and only a dim light filtered in from the corridor. Suddenly, as he was kneeling before me, I noticed a shadow on the wall. It was a silhouette of a bearded man, and he seemed to be creeping nearer and nearer to Jackson. The poor fellow noticed the shadow almost as soon as I did. "Save me from him, Father," he screamed. "He will not let me go." Even as I looked, it seemed that a second pair of hands were forming over Jackson's. I lifted the crucifix and cried out, "In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, I bid you return to the place from whence you have come." As I uttered the words, I was hurled across the cell by a powerful hand, and I distinctly saw two green eyes looking balefully into mine. But I had one. Jackson was sobbing gently, but he was still Jackson, and the confession was finished without further incident. In the morning, I rode over with the Blessed Sacrament and was relieved to hear that Jackson had passed a quiet night. He knelt reverently to receive the host, but just as I was about to place it on his tongue, a hand gripped my wrist and held it back. I managed to make the sign of the cross with the Holy Sacrament, and as I did so, my wrist was set free from the grip, and a most unholy howl echoed through the cell. But I, through the grace of God, had won. I knew it with absolute certainty, and I also knew that the foul thing from the grave could never approach Sidney Jackson again. "And what happened to Jackson after he had been restored to his normal self?" asked the doctor. The asylum authorities kept a very careful eye upon him, and after 3 years he was released. He is now a lay brother in a community of enclosed monks in the Austrian Tyrol. "An astounding story," exclaimed the doctor, "and it only goes to prove the existence of such things as disembodied spirits." "Ah, yes," said the bishop quietly, "but I think you will agree that it also proves the wisdom of the church in refusing to allow her children to dabble in the thing called spiritualism." "I think it does," the doctor agreed. Mr. Ash's Studio by H.R. Wakefield. It was a return of the road-breaking battalion with their accursed compressed ear drills, which made Mr. Horrocks' graying hairs bristle with determination. He could oathfully endure the foul orchestra of horns and gears, the cacophony of canned dance music, even the piano pounding of the infernal brat in the flat below. But at the first renewal of that quivering, booming patter from East Street, he knew something must be done if he was to finish his novel. "Why not take a studio while you're looking for another flat?" said a friend in the club. He picked up a copy of the Connoisseur. "Here you are, within 10 minutes' walk of Knightsbridge Tube Station. Roomy, outdoor studio. Very quiet. Easy terms. Why not have a look at that? There are heaps of others vacant if it doesn't suit you." Very occasionally, about twice a year, Mr. Horrocks acted with extreme decision. Within 10 minutes, he was on his way to the agent's. He was a small, sturdy, thrusting little person of 46. He had a long head, rather flat along the top, the hair at the sides brushed forward, which gave him a slightly old-fashioned appearance. His eyes were very quick and dark, a mouth small and mobile, chin pointed but emphatic. He made a rather contradictory impression on the discerning beholder. Alert but contemplative, irascible but benign, he regarded censors, killjoys, Puritans, and that sort with an unbridled loathing in theory. But if he came in actual contact with one of them, he was, in practice, courteous, understanding, reasonable, inquisitive, the true novelist's mind being inevitably time-serving. "Anyone in Rupert's Court will direct you," said the agent, handing him a key. "Ask for Mr. Ash's studio." "Thank you," replied Mr. Horrocks, and trotted off. Keeping a wary eye open, he eventually discovered Rupert's Court, which began in a narrow arch passageway off the Brompton Road and developed into what had been known in his youth as a mews. now is a series of lock-up garages and an occasional small private house, rebuilt coachman's quarters. There were many chauffeurs sluicing and attending to their charges. Mr. Horrocks, looking round for a guide, caught sight of a tall young man standing at the door of a charming little yellow house with gay blue window boxes. Mr. Horrocks went up to him and put his question. "Certainly," he replied in a pleasant, genial way. "Come with me." He conducted Mr. Horrocks to an opening on the right-hand side, round the corner where a small, square-railed in-grass space. At the far end was a rather high hut with corrugated iron roof, over which leaned a plane tree with many drooping branches. "That's the studio," said the tall young man. "The door is up at the other end." "Thanks very much," said Mr. Horrocks. "It looks nice and quiet." The young man seemed to be considering something. "Are you a painter?" he asked presently. "No," replied Mr. Horrocks. "I try to write. My name is Samuel Horrocks, but I suppose you haven't heard of it." "Of course I have. And may I say, I greatly admire your stories of the supernatural. May I ask how you were put onto this studio?" "Oh, I just happened to see it advertised." The young man remained thoughtful for a moment. Then he appeared to make up his mind. "Well," he said, "I hope you'll find it is all right for your purposes. My name is Landon, and I live in that little yellow house. If I can be of any service to you, let me know." Mr. Horrocks thanked him, and they said goodbye. "Very courteous young fellow," thought Mr. Horrocks, as he stepped forward. "Looks highly intelligent, too, but I wonder what service he thought he could render me. Ah, there was the door." He pushed the key in the lock. He had to use some force to open the door as it was jammed from damp, he supposed, at the bottom and sides. He found himself in a room surprisingly more spacious than its exterior suggested. There appeared to be two rooms, as a matter of fact, for there was another door at the far end. The place was lit by three high windows. It smelled rather fusty, and there were patches of damp on the distempered walls. Ah, there was an easel with a picture on it, and a couple of rather dilapidated chairs. He'd seen what was behind the other door. It was another room, quite a small one, full of odds and ends, packing cases, an oil stove, a kettle, and so on. What a peculiar smell! What was that red stain on the small packing case? He bent down. Good heavens! It was alive, a cluster of moths. How very curious. Beautiful color. They must be feeding on something. He put out his hand to disturb them, when suddenly they all sprang up at his face. Little brutes, he lashed out at them and beat a hasty retreat, shutting the door behind him. Venomous little beasts. Well, what about this studio? He wasn't greatly taken with it, but it was most certainly quiet. Mr. Horrocks was a shop assistant's glad dream, for he almost invariably took the first thing offered him and hurried out of the shop. The last thing he wanted was to go hunting about, fussing with agents and keys, and asking his way and that sort of thing. He wanted a place to work in, and he wanted it at once. This would surely do. Not in the winter, perhaps, but with the summer coming on. Why not in the winter? Mr. Horrocks vaguely considered this proviso. Too damp, perhaps, and also, well, there was something rather somber about it. It was the contrast, no doubt, between its aloofness, quietness, and isolation, and the raging stress and promiscuous din only 100 yards away. Something like that. Oh yes, it would do. He'd get a desk in and a stove for the damp and just exploit that aloofness and quiet. That was settled. He strolled over to the easel. Portrait of a woman, good-looking girl, in a very beautiful, and yet there was something about her expression, something enigmatic. Wonder who this fellow Ash was. There was his palette and brushes on the floor behind the easel. Curious, smudged, rainbow thing, a palette. It was rather humiliating, but he hadn't really the smallest knowledge of the way a painter went to work. However, he'd never pretended otherwise. How loud his footsteps sounded on the wood floor. Showed how quiet it was. Before leaving, he peeped through the door into the small room. Yes, there they were, back again, forming a sort of pattern. Wonderful patch of color, dark ruby. Little brute seemed to be staring at him. He'd take the studio that afternoon for a month. That was settled, and a great relief. As he caught hold of the door on getting outside, it seemed to swing hard at him of its own momentum, and it slammed harshly, thrusting him back. He was a little ruffled. Not exactly a hospitable atmosphere about that place, he thought. The tall young man was still standing outside the yellow house as he repassed up the court. "Well?" he asked. "I've decided to take it," said Mr. Horrocks. "It's not perhaps a very cheerful spot, but its quietness decided me." The young man nodded. "Are you taking it for long?" "No, just by the month." "I see. Well, good luck with the book. I hope you'll give us some more ghost stories soon." "It's rather difficult to get plots for them," replied Mr. Horrocks, "but I'll do my best. Good morning." 3 days later, he revisited the studio, which now housed a desk, a couple of comfortable chairs, and his portable typewriter. It was a brilliantly fine May morning, and the place seemed a bit more genial, but not really very much, he considered. However, now for work. He was about a third of the way through his novel, and irritatingly uncertain exactly how to develop it. Also, he had promised his agent to have a ghost story ready fairly soon for the Christmas number of a magazine, which paid very well. But at the moment, he hadn't an idea in his head. For the time being, he would concentrate on the novel. He sat down at his desk and began to cogitate. His weakness, he knew it well, was a tendency to flippancy. The more he saw and read of the world and its denizens, the far harder he found it to take them with a proper seriousness. As far as the tale of humanity was concerned, he was inclined to laugh at the wrong places, a serious flaw in a novelist. His characters would adopt an unbecoming impishness at critical moments and mock their creator's efforts to control them. It was probably due to the fact that their creator had never succeeded in measuring humanity flatteringly in accordance with a cosmic scale. He was therefore delighted to find that the atmosphere of Mr. Ashe's studio was an excellent corrective to this levity. He wrote a whole chapter by lunchtime, a very critical chapter, and he knew that it was good. The motley streak was rigidly eliminated from it. With an aching arm but satisfied soul, he got up at 1:30, yawned, stretched himself, and found himself regarding the picture on the easel. Seen by the stronger light, it appeared a very vivid piece of work. It almost seemed as if it had been more worked on than when he'd seen it before. Certainly her face was a puzzle. He went up to it and covered first her eyes, then her mouth and chin, with his hand in an attempt to discover where the secret of that oddness lay. As a result, he decided it was eminent and not to be traced. He'd have a look and see what those little red devils were doing. There they were, bunched on the packing case, making that same pattern, motionless and intent. Funny pattern, almost like a human face. Vague memories of bug hunting at school came back to him. He was very certain that nothing resembling them had ever found its way into his killing bottle. Singular markings on their heads. He bent down, and at once the swarm rose together and flew savagely onto his face. He struck out at them. How extraordinary! It seemed impossible to touch one. Artful little dodgers. What a filthy smell they made. Nauseating and corrupt. He'd leave them alone in future. He spent the day at Kew Gardens, in his opinion, the most delectable place in the world on a fine spring day. As he strolled about the lawns and threw crumbs to the birds, he sought some inspiration for that infernal ghost story. A reviewer had once credited him with the possession of a malignant imagination for such fiction. At the moment, he had a malignant lack of it. All the same, the atmosphere of that studio ought to be kinetic. Presently, he felt like a rest and sat down on a seat by the flowers. Drowsily, he began to daydream. A succession of images elusively patrolled his brain. A girl's head on an easel, a dark stain on a packing case. He found himself examining the studio almost inch by inch, for his visualizing power was very highly developed. He scrutinized the girl's face closely and then was jerked back into full consciousness, for it had seemed to him that a brush had fallen on the face and slightly emphasized the line from her left nostril to upper lip. Amusing illusion. Might be an idea for a story there. Whole thing taking place in narrator's subconscious. Damn difficult. Well, he must be getting home. Those roadbreakers would have knocked off by the time he reached there. From then on, he went to the studio 4 days a week, always in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon. He invariably approached it with oddly mixed emotions. Never had he known any place more stimulating to his imagination, yet he never felt at home there. The moment he unlocked the door, he felt a sense of obscure excitement, which in fact began to come over him as soon as he passed into Rupert's court and intensified itself until he was actually inside and face to face with the girl on the easel. And as he arose, he often paused and looked up at her. Each time he came to the studio, she seemed subtly and indefinably to have changed, developed, become at once more realized, yet harder to nail down and analyze. He imagined that was what was meant by learning to see a painting, that like a poem or a piece of music, it only revealed its inner, profounder meaning to those who lavished as much care in deciphering it as the artist had in inscribing it. She was very useful, too, for she seemed to have become identified in a way with the chief female character in his novel. Heroine would have been a somewhat satirical term for the dark-hearted vampire, and how excellently and reassuringly the book was going. For once, his publisher's plaintive and oft-repeated blurb insistence that Samuel Horrocks' latest work is also his greatest showed every evidence of being justified. Certainly, it revealed an almost ruthless lack of flippancy. As it moved to its inevitable climax, the shadows darkened and gathered around it. That meant drastically revising the first third of it, a laborious necessity, but unescapable. He left the little room and the moths alone. Their business was none of his, he felt, and somehow they were peculiar to the place. He gathered that Mr. Ashe, whoever he might be, had felt a keen interest in them, for he discovered a little sketchbook, presumably his, on one of the window ledges. This contained dozens of preliminary studies for the girl's head, each one decoratively framed in moth clusters. One of them gave rather a dubious reaction, for the girl's head was flung back from her shoulders, and there was poured over her face a stream of dark red, delicately though unmistakably articulated, into the crouched shape of moths. What the artist was thinking about when he put his pencil to work on so morbid a conception, Mr. Horrocks was at a loss to understand. Yet it fascinated him, and he several times examined it in a hurried, shamefaced way. All the time, if it hadn't been someone else's property, he was almost certain he would have torn it into very small pieces. He spent perhaps 20 hours a week in the studio, yet in a sense he was there for much longer. That was due to his recently developed tendency to daydream, reinforced by his abnormal power of visualization. This tendency was by no means welcome. In fact, it was decidedly exasperating, for his subconscious, the breeding ground, he supposed, of these daydreams appeared to be quite determined they should be compelled to take an urgent interest in what occurred at the studio when its tenant wasn't there. Of course, nothing went on, and yet the fact remained that he might be taking a walk or trying to read when all of a sudden he would find himself, as it were, just inside the studio and regarding its interior. His view of it was hazy and it appeared much diminished, but it was quite recognizable. He couldn't see his desk or chairs, but there was the girl's head on the easel, and there was the window and the door into the little room, and he was forced to admit there was frequently something else, someone, to be more precise. And that he, yes, it was a man, was moving about, a tall man with an odd walk, as if he limped. But however hard he concentrated, he could never quite get this person into focus. The effort to do so often made him sweat and his heart race, but he simply couldn't get a proper look at this person's face. Surely he was tall and dark. Who could it be? While he was still in this fussed state, and before he pulled himself together and called himself a fool, he often felt a violent, crazy impulse to dash off to Rupert's Court to make quite certain whether there was or was not someone prowling about the studio. More than once, he could only just rally enough strength of mind to resist his insensate craving. He reassured himself that this eccentric preoccupation with a dingy hut was a symptom of overwork. Not exactly that, perhaps, but excessive absorption in his novel. But how blessed that all those wavering uncertain currents had coalesced so perfectly into a steady stream. He had to thank the dingy hut for that, and he could see the end in sight. He met Landon when he was leaving the studio late one afternoon and accepted his invitation to come in for a glass of sherry. The little house was as charming inside as out, fitted and furnished with a nice careless discretion. "So you really find the place a congenial workshop?" his host inquired on hearing of the progress the book was making. "Well, it depends on what you mean by that," replied Mr. Horrocks. "I've certainly written 40,000 words there, and as golfers say, I don't want them back. But congenial, well, I mustn't be ungrateful, but it's not an adjective I feel appropriate to the place." Landon was silent for a moment. "No," he said presently, "I think I understand what you mean." "You've been inside it?" "Oh, yes," said Landon. "It's got an atmosphere of its own, almost, one might say, a personality. There are places like that, I think." "Are you clairvoyant in that way? I mean, have you had actual experience of a psychic sort?" "As a matter of fact, I have," replied Mr. Horrocks. "Quite a number, but as I've found that these experiences were not shared by others, I've kept quiet about them." "That is my case also," said Landon, "and I've learned to keep my mouth shut. When to open it results in being regarded as a self-assertive liar. It must be a great relief to you to get them out of your system in the form of fiction. Are you writing a story now?" Mr. Horrocks shrugged his shoulders. "I'm not sure," he said, "but I'm inclined to think there is one forming itself in my harassed old pate. But I mustn't hurry it or keep pulling it up to have a look, like an impatient fisherman. If it's hooking or something, I shall feel that unmistakable bite when the time comes." "That's a rather revealing metaphor," said Landon. "I can't write fiction, think of stories myself. I'm an architect, but I understand just what you mean. By the way, I always remember that story of yours, at the going down of the sun. I believe the ray theory of psychic phenomena you hinted at there is the most probable." "It was the undoubted evidence for phantoms of the living which gave me the idea," replied Mr. Horrocks, somewhat gratified. "Yes, quite," said Landon. "By the way, you don't work at night in the studio, do you?"
"I haven't so far."
"Well, I shouldn't. There are some tough characters about this neighborhood at night. If they saw a light, they might pay you a somewhat unceremonious visit."
"I should, of course, lock the door," said Mr. Horrocks.
"Yes, naturally, but all the same, I shouldn't run any risk." At length, the day came when Mr. Horrocks typed the word Finis and the date below it. May 29th, and knew that the preceding 90,000 words represented the best work he'd done in his life. So good and yet so alien to his customary manner, both in atmosphere and style, that he hardly recognized it as his. Almost, he modestly said to himself, as he'd been a tiny bit inspired. Tomorrow he'd hand it to his publisher and go straight off to Cornwall for a long rest, and then he'd start hunting for a tolerably quiet flat. So it was goodbye to the studio. Would he be sorry to bid it farewell? Once again, he failed to give a decided answer to that question. It had been a most excellent tonic and stimulant to his imagination. Yet he was a little afraid of it. Yes, better to say the word. There was something about it which ruffled his nerves, and no doubt caused that ridiculous yet oppressive daydreaming. He'd have a last leisurely stroll around it, and a last look at the girl. It really was a most baffling illusion, for he could have sworn that the expression on her face had drastically changed. She was still exquisitely beautiful, and she always looked like the one to be wary of, but now she wore an air of mocking, heartless frigidity, a most lovely, perilous vampire, a devil. He had a sudden desire to crash his fist into her face, and then he laughed at himself and said out loud, "Well, my most adorable but evil one, I shan't see you again. Give my love to Mr. Ashe, and—" He stopped abruptly. He had spoken in a light, bantering tone, but the echo of his words came back to him in a most mournful yet somehow mocking way. He felt a sudden gust of uneasiness and depression, impulsively turned the canvas round. On the back of it he casually noticed some carefully drawn but undecipherable hieroglyphics. And now, for a last look at the little red beasts, yes, there they were, glowing motionless and obscene, like a stain of blood with 100 eyes. Supposing he picked up that piece of planking and crashed it down on them. The little devils seemed to read his thoughts, for they sprang up at him and drove him from the room. How he stank! Well, that was that. As he opened the door to leave, he took a last look back, and then the door swung hard at him. Runk, and slammed to. As he strolled towards his club for lunch, his mind turned to the subject of that infernal ghost story he'd got to write. It was beginning to get urgent.
obscurely he felt that the studio was the only place in which to conceive of it and write it. Perhaps he'd given it up too soon. What a curse it was. Just as he'd finished a most delicate and exhausting piece of work, he got to tackle another. Well, he would have one day off, he told himself irritably. If his imagination wouldn't let him rest, he'd drown it. The bank rate had been lowered that morning, and his business friends at the club, who'd been feeling the overdraft severely, were in the mood for some alcoholic enthusiasm and celebration. Mr. Horrocks was reasonably abstemious, but for once he found their spiritual state catching and comforting. Consequently, after a large and cheerful lunch, sherry, hock, and a double port, he was more than prepared for a restorative snooze and his favorite chair in the chess room. It was sweet and dreamless, so he was all the more annoyed when, on awaking, he found himself staring, not at the trees in St. James Park, but straight down the length of the studio. And there was that. No, he wouldn't look. He got up brusquely and went to the bar. He completely mistrusted the Fata Morgana amenities of alcohol, but his nerves were jangled, and something must be done. He did it with discretion. The result was quite unexpected and bizarre, for he began to experience an exalted resolve to visit the studio again that night, and then and there conceive of that accursed short story. He was sure of it. He'd have a good dinner, just enough to keep his optimism untarnished, but leave his head fairly clear, and he'd get that story. It sounded ludicrous, but he had such irrational surges of certainty before, and they'd always been justified. He would go. Successfully maintaining his resolution and good hope, he hailed a taxi at 10:30 and 20 minutes later was at Rupert's Court, feeling rather excited and adventurous. Yet the enterprise began to reveal itself rather more starkly in the court than it had in the club smoking room. It was a boisterous night, the wind veering to the west and stiffening sharply. The weather was breaking, and with much loud cloud, it was very dark. Rupert's Court appeared desolate and uninviting. Lander seemed to be in, as there was light in his sitting room. This reminded Mr. Horrocks of his advice about not visiting the studio after dark. Oh well, he could take care of himself. As he turned the corner, he took an electric torch from his pocket. That tree made it damn dark. What a wind! Curious sound the branches made on the roof, like stealthy footsteps. How was the keyhole? Door had stuck as usual. He put his shoulder to it, whereupon it yielded so suddenly that he staggered forward and dropped the torch. Then the door swung back and crashed. Now, where was that cursed torch? His hand swept the floor. Ah, there it was. Click, click. Blast the thing, it wouldn't work now. Yes, just a faint glow. He'd wait a moment till his eyes got used to it. Rather a fool to have come. What was he really doing in this rather dreadful place? How those branches lashed the roof. Yes, really rather a dreadful place. What would those moths be doing? Probably just making that pattern and listening to him, their foul little eyes staring in intent. He moved forward cautiously. He could just see his way now. What a daunting suggestion of menace seemed hovering in the place. Well, that was an absurd exaggeration. After all, that was the atmosphere he'd come to absorb. Hello? What was that? It seemed almost as if the room had become smaller, as if the walls had become crouching in towards him. Ah, there was the easel. But he turned the girl's face round. Who could have? Good God. The moths were on it. He stood motionless and rigid, his heart beating wildly, for wasn't her head flung back from the shoulders? And weren't they crawling? And weren't those walls closing in on him? And who was that standing and watching him from the small door? For a moment he felt he could never move again. Then he wrenched himself free and began to run for the door. He dropped the torch and with trembling hands groped his way along a wall. Where was the door? Was that it? No. Yes, yes. As he flung it open, it seemed as though a myriad little wings came beating round his eyes. He tore down the path, the door crashing to behind him. As he reached the corner, someone approached him. He flinched back. Then a voice said, "It's all right. This is Landon. You're perfectly safe. Come with me." "But how did you know?" cried Mr. Horrocks hysterically. "I heard you shouting," replied quietly, "and guessed the rest." Mr. Horrocks walked panting by his side to his house and into the sitting room. There was a tantalus and glasses on the table. "Sit down," said Landon, "and make yourself comfortable while I mix you a drink."
"It's very good of you," said Mr. Horrocks. "I'm afraid I quite lost my head, but I had rather a shock. I see now I should have taken your advice, but I didn't realize."
"Perhaps I should have been more explicit," replied Landon, handing him a glass. "But as you found the place congenial for your writing, I didn't want to prejudice you against it, but it is, of course, well, shall we say, highly impregnated? You've got into such matters far more than I, but as you have stated, they remain without convincing explanation."
"Absolutely so," said Mr. Horrocks, raising his glass with a still unsteady hand. "Any tentative suggestion I have made were simply guesswork. There is no theory ever advanced which begins to cover the ground. It was horrible, horrible!"
"I'll give you as much facts as I know about that studio," said Landon, sitting down and lighting a cigarette.
"It was built by a person named Raphael Ashe 4 years ago. His father was a Highland Scot in business at Tehran. There he married a Persian woman of high degree. Their son was brought up in Persia and eventually sent to Oxford. A friend of mine was up at New College with him. He was a very enigmatic character, outwardly imperturbable and bland, yet keeping himself aloof from college life and somehow forbidding. He was extremely unpopular for some reason, I believe not unconnected with a certain doubt as to how he spent his plentiful leisure time. The occupants of the other rooms in his quarter thought at times they saw and heard somewhat dubious things, so four enterprising and intoxicated sportsmen broke into his rooms one night. They got rather badly frightened, but would say nothing of their experience. By a coincidence, they all died within a year or so. Ash came under the notice of the college authorities and was sent down by them after a couple of terms for reasons best known to themselves, whereupon he built his studio and began to paint. He also fell in love. I may say he inherited a great deal of money. The lady concerned seemed for a time to reciprocate his feelings, and she certainly made his money fly. However, someone else desired her, and he was just as rich and socially far more eligible. I knew this lady, and you have seen a brilliantly clever likeness of her, but no portrait could do her justice. She was exquisitely lovely, an accomplished actress, and an utterly immoral, soulless rogue. Well, she married the other man and went to live with him at his place in Surrey. A few weeks later, she met her death. She was seen one afternoon by a gamekeeper running through a wood near the house. He stated at the inquest that she was beating out at something with her hands. He imagined she was being attacked by a swarm of bees and ran after her, but before he could reach her, she had fallen over the edge of a quarry. She was dying when he got to her, but still beating out with her hands as if to keep something from her face. Shortly after, Ash was shot dead in the small room in the studio.
"Good God," exclaimed Mr. Horrocks. "Was it suicide?"
"That was the verdict," replied Landon slowly. "The evidence was slightly conflicting. One witness stated that he had heard voices coming from the studio that afternoon, and the medical evidence was slightly indefinite. However, the coroner was satisfied."
"Well, that's all I know about Mr. Ashe and his studio, or almost. When I came to live here, I discovered it had a certain reputation amongst the frequenters of the court. I wondered why. Got the key and went there late one winter evening. And then I no longer wondered. It has one temporary tenant beside you since Ashe died. He gave it up after a few days. I believe it to be pulled down soon. And now you must have another little drink, and I'll join you."
"Well, just a very small one. There is one other thing, those moths."
"You will not find their like in the Natural History Museum," replied Landon. "Perhaps you might search the world over and never do so, for I once described them to a distinguished Orientalist, and he told me that he never met anyone who had encountered such an insect, but that he'd receive obscure hints concerning such creatures, though there was a very general reluctance to refer to them. Once or twice he had succeeded in overcoming this reluctance. He gathered that they were known as the servants of Eblis, in a rough translation. Personally, he didn't believe in their existence and was greatly puzzled as to how I'd heard of them. I will tell you something. You and one other are the only persons I've known who could see them."
"Who could see them?" echoed Mr. Horrocks, astonished.
"Yes, I've made some experiments. You and I, in that respect, at least, are privileged people." "And that other?" asked Mr. Horrocks after a pause.
"She's dead," replied Landon quietly. Mr. Horrocks was silent for a while. Presently he said, "Was Ash very dark, and did he limp slightly?"
"Yes," replied Landon.